We're turning to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6 for a familiar verse of Scripture. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6 says, "Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it." I remember a long time ago, 30 years ago, in fact, when our first daughter was born, some older man said to me, "We really ought to weep when they're born and rejoice when they die." Now, that's not really what you want to hear when a child is born. And really, the more I begin to look at that, that's a pagan worldview. Throughout history, the pagans regarded children as a liability. In history, deformed babies were drowned and unwanted babies were abandoned. In case you like to read someone else's mail, the archaeologists found a letter written from Alexandria, Egypt, and the date was June the 17th, and the year was 1 BC. A husband was away from home, and he wrote his wife who was expecting. And here's what he wrote her. He said, "If it is a male child, let it live. If it is a female, cast it out." Now, that's the view that people had of children in those days. But that's not the Christian view of children. Jesus says a woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. But when the child is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child is born into the world. The Christian worldview is that we rejoice when a new life has come into the world. Because over in the Psalms, Psalm 127 teaches that children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. It's not a curse. It's not a liability. But the fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. This is the Christian outlook. Jesus taught us that children are important. What's his disciples were running interference. They realized that Jesus was a busy and important man. And they began to block the parents who wanted to bring their children to Jesus for a blessing. And the Bible here says that when Jesus discovered that's what was happening, he was indignant. If you look at the Greek word, I'll just be honest with you, it says he was angry. Jesus was upset. And he said at that point, "Let all the little children come unto me, and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven." In another place, Jesus says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." That verse seems to imply that maybe angels are assigned to little ones. It speaks of their angels. But Jesus says, don't despise these little ones. In Christian doctrine, children are important for at least three reasons. They're important, first of all, because they are created in the image and likeness of God. Secondly, Jesus says they're in the kingdom of God. And thirdly, they are our future. They have the potential to advance the agenda of our Lord Jesus Christ. I realize that this morning is a very significant service. And that I have a distinct privilege. As I walked up to the church this morning, I realized that I would be christening and dedicating a little one who would outlive me. And I realized that we're looking at future. We're looking at hope. We're looking at longevity. We're looking at potential. Somebody just put it in these words, every newborn baby is God's declaration that the world should go on. Now, sometimes we get a little bit down in the mouth, don't we? And we say, "I don't know what this world is coming to." And we begin to talk about all the we've always had problems. We always will have problems. But God is in control. And as long as He keeps sending new ones into this world, we have a responsibility to train them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And so parents are charged with this serious responsibility. Ephesians 6:4 literally says fathers, but we expand it to fathers and mothers or parents. Bring your children up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. even before there was a United States, an English poet by the name of Alexander Pope penned these famous words. I venture to say many of you will recognize these. 'Tis education forms the common mind. Just as the twig is bent, the tree's inclined. Have you ever heard that before? As the twig is bent, we say, so grows the tree. We realize that parents and extended family and churches and teachers all are responsible in bending. Now, we're not here to break that twig, but we are here to direct it or bend it the right direction. I'm sure that nearly everyone has heard this old statement, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And so again, these are expressions, along with the words of Solomon, that reminds us of the responsibility of parents. Both Tosh and Christy are employed in public education, but many parents are not quite sure about this matter of educating their children. And that's what I want to focus on, training our children. It's not simply enough to provide our children their basic needs, such as food and clothing and shelter. We are to teach our children about God. And we are to bring our children to Christ. A child is born with a never-dying soul. And that soul very early begins to reach out to his or her Creator and respond to God's preliminary grace, which is already reaching out to them. And I'm suggesting that education is more than just teaching how to make a living. Education is learning how to live. Children very early begin to think, begin to ask questions, and don't they ask questions? They begin to develop a conscience. They begin to learn right from wrong. And much of this development is occurring before they ever go off to school. Much of this education happens at home. And much of it is not formal. It's not between certain hours. It's not out of a textbook. But it happens as we live our lives. And much of a child's early development comes from exposure to their parents. God has given them a mind. And as the advertisement says, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. God says we're to love Him with our whole heart and soul and mind. We're to love Him with our mind. Do not stifle their curiosity to know. It is a God-given thing. I think sometimes after question 99, sometimes we're just tempted to say, or you wouldn't say this, but some parents would say, would you just shut up? Sometimes we just feel like saying that. But let me just say that when your children begin to ask questions like, how did I get here? And you realize that's going to lead to another question, isn't it? And they're going to say, who made me? And ironically, they all ask this question. Sooner or later, they're going to say, who made God? And pretty soon you say, I'm in over my head. They're asking questions I can't answer. What is heaven like? What is the devil like? They begin to ask all these kinds of questions. And I want to tell you that that is very important. That's formative. It is said that 40% of a child's personality and thought patterns are developed before the age of 2. That's frightening to think of that, isn't it? That if that is true, that 40% of their development occurs before the age of 2. I was looking at childhood development theory again this morning a little bit, and they're saying that a well-nurtured infant by the age of 2 has developed trust and security and a basic optimism about life. But if they grew up in an unstable environment, they have already got started on the wrong foot. Another 40% of a child's personality is developed between the ages of 2 to 6. And here they begin to develop a conscience. They begin to develop a sense of right and wrong. By the age of 6, their personality and their direction may be 80% determined. Now, that doesn't mean that we cannot change as we get older, but it does mean that it's harder to change. We know that the older we get, the harder it is. And so in my notes, I've got a statement here, children are like wet concrete. Some of you know instinctively what that means. If you've ever worked with concrete, you realize that the clock is ticking. And that you can move and push and pull and level out that concrete any way you want it to go, but you realize you can't do it tomorrow. You can't say, I think I'll take a vacation and do it when I come back. You realize you've got hours, don't you? And all of a sudden, what was once pliable and moldable begins to set up. It develops a rigidity. And if it's gone the wrong way, you may have to bring in a jackhammer. And that's what it's like for some of us to change habits. It takes that kind of a jackhammer dynamic to change us because we have become rigid and set in our ways. You see, good habits are the best thing you have going for you. Bad habits are the worst thing you have working against you. And I'm saying that we can change. I just say this to people of all ages. We sometimes have this old statement, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. The reason that's not true is we're not dogs. See, we're created in the image and likeness of God. Yes, God can change you. The oldest one here can still change, but it may take a jackhammer to change us. That's what I'm saying. Change occurs. Here's a formula. Change occurs with three components. Truth and time and grace. God can change you over time if you will face the truth and appropriate His grace. But what I'm saying is the problem in some people's lives is it's not a matter that they're an old dog. You know, God can change us. The problem is in some families, we actually spend more time training our dog than we do training our children. Some people have a dog that will mind and a child that won't mind. And what I'm saying is, if we would just spend the time in training our children that we do in training our pets, you're going to get a good reward for doing that. Now, the text literally says that a child will develop a taste for whatever touches his or her palate. If we were to go into the Hebrew here, train up or start up a child, if you look at the history of this word, we have to go back before the days of gerbil baby food. And way back even before you were around, mothers would take, over in that part of the world, they would take a fig or a date. They would put it in their own mouth, and they would chew it until it was moist and pliable. And then they would take some of that and put it on their own finger. And they would reach in and put it in the very back of the child's mouth, touching the palate. That's literally what this verb train up means. It means to touch the palate. And you know, if you touch the right spot, that there'll be an automatic reflex, and the child will involuntarily swallow. Now, it's interesting, the first time they encounter a new taste, we're watching this now with Mirella, and many times her face will just kind of contort just a little bit, and she's not sure what she's experiencing. She's just now learning that there's more in this world than milk. This is a big world. But what I'm saying is that when you touch that palate, whatever they experience, whatever they encounter will be the things that shape and mold them. Briella is learning that she likes sweet potatoes and peas. And actually, she is also discovering ice cream and Dr. Pepper. And yesterday, I don't know if her mother knows all this or not, but yesterday I put the first French fry in her mouth. And her face just looked horrible. And I thought she was going to cry for a moment. But she just kept gnawing on that French fry. And before long, she developed a taste for it. Now, in some parts of the world, they may not like French fries. But I think it's safe to say she'll like them. Whether they're good for her or not, she'll like them. In my first pastorate, there was a Hispanic man who told me that as a small child, his mother would make these homemade tortilla chips. He would take a big one and he'd go outside to the pepper plant. And he said he'd pick off a jalapeno pepper and taste it, and if it wasn't hot, he'd throw it aside, and he'd bite another one. Just as a little, I thought he said he crawled out there to it. But he'd keep testing till he found one that was good and hot, and then he would eat it along with that tortilla chip. Now, what's interesting is some of you couldn't eat one right now. Some of you as adults would get upset to your stomach if you tried to eat that. How is it that that little infant could eat a hot jalapeno? You see, that's what his palate was touched with. That's what he was raised with. That's what he grew up on. And I'm just trying to illustrate, this is what the text is teaching. I am weighing out whether to, how much detail to go in here. I'm afraid that you may feel I'm unpatriotic in what I'm about to say. But I'll just go ahead and say it anyway. I was a grown man before I'd ever tasted grits. And I know I'm giving it away. I know I'm a foreigner. But I can eat them, but I still don't see anything to get excited about. You see, it's what you're raised with. My middle name, just to tell you a little bit about myself, my middle name is Paul. I was named for a man named Paul McGehee. He never had any children of his own, but he was office editor, published a denominational magazine, and held the same job for 61 years. Now, my parents hardly ever used a babysitter. As a matter of fact, he and his wife were really the only babysitter I ever remember having. To tell you a little bit about my own family, none of them had gone to college, and they really did not value books. But when I'd go and stay with Paul and his wife, Paul would read to me. As a matter of fact, he had a shelf that was full of books. I can remember looking in that shelf of books. He had the works of Josephus. He had Adam Clark's commentary. He had about more books than I'd ever seen before. And as I got older, as soon as he was finished with the news magazine, next Sunday when I'd see him at church, he always had something in the car for me to read. I don't think my parents realized what was going on, but I was being shaped and molded and influenced by this old gentleman. One day he died, and I got word that I had inherited his old typewriter that he'd used for many years. It's over 100 years old, and it sits in my office. And if you were to come to my office, along one wall, there's bookshelves from ceiling to floor. Along the second wall, there's bookshelves from ceiling to floor. Along the third wall, there's bookshelves from ceiling to floor. They're all filled, and many of those shelves are stacked too deep. Now, I hope I'm not turning you off. I know that some people think that's geekish. I wasn't raised around books. But really, if I was to go shopping, the only shopping I enjoy doing would be going to a good used bookstore. I love the world of books. And all I'm trying to illustrate is not how geeky the preacher is. All I'm trying to illustrate is, anybody want to venture a guess as to where I developed a love for books? I didn't get it in my own home. I got it by staying with this older gentleman. Since 1993, I have served as general editor for a publishing company, and of all things, I edit a magazine. Now, I got to thinking, in preparation for this service, I don't know how many books and videos and CDs I've got loaned out, but if I think you're interested in anything at all, I'll find you sooner or later. I'll loan you something to watch or read. You know where I got that? That's what Paul was doing to me. He was discipling me. He was feeding me information. I've got stuff loaned out to students and to members and to friends. You see, I just picked up that habit by what I was exposed to. Now, I might as well just give you a full disclosure. I have learned to like Carolina barbecue. And they do know my face at Hickory Hills. But just to speak from my heart, when Bev and I got back to Kansas City, one of the first things we did, I hope you're not offended, but one of the first things we did was get some real barbecue. And I took one bite and I looked at Bev and I said, "Now Bev, when the Lord said, 'Let there be barbecue,' this is what he had in mind." Now, you may eat it and say, I prefer what I grew up on. But you see, I'm trying to illustrate the same point. It's hard to get away from your raising. It's hard to get away from what you're exposed to. If I haven't thoroughly offended you up to this point, maybe I will now. But I'll tell you that when you get the reasoners together, it's not very long until we start pulling out guitars and banjos and mandolins. And if you would ask my grandson what kind of music he likes to listen to, he'd say bluegrass. Now, you may hate it. I've encountered plenty who do. But that's what we were raised on. And again, those things are tastes. They're preferences that we learn. You don't just sit down and read a book and tell Will, this is what you're to eat, this is what... He picks it up. I don't know what the favorite food is in the Corley household, and I don't know what your favorite type of music is. But what I want to say to you, Tosh and Christy, you are establishing the tastes and preferences of your children. You're training them. You're influencing them. And the really important thing is that you learn to pray with your children. Bring them to church. Read to them. And sometimes, when the TV's on, you may just have to pick up the clicker and turn it off and look at Will or RT or Lily and say, "The Corleys don't talk like that." Sometimes we just have to make that a teachable moment. The point is that whatever a child is exposed to is what shapes them and what molds them. I'm in favor of parents reading to children and singing to children and praying to children while they're still in the womb. Be careful about using the TV as your babysitter. Some people say, "Well, it doesn't matter. They'll be exposed to it sooner or later." Well, if I can give you my 2 cents, make it later instead of sooner. Make it as much later as you can. And in the meantime, develop a positive point of reference before they start encountering profanity and violence and killing and prejudice. Push that off as far as you can. It's unavoidable. I know it's in our world, but don't bring it in. Don't introduce it any sooner than is necessary. Try to get God and love and the things that matter on the agenda first. Someone wrote, "If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. But if a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with fairness, he learns justice. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world." And so, Tosh and Christy, I challenge you to bring up Will in the way that he should go. Bring him up with tolerance and encouragement and praise and fairness and security and approval and acceptance. And bring him up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. In this ceremony that we're about to enter into, Will's parents will enter into a covenant with God on behalf of Will to raise him the very best that they're able to do. You as a congregation act as witnesses to this covenant agreement. And I will bless Will as God's representative. You say, "Why would we devote a whole service just for one child?" Well, first of all, this ceremony reminds those of us who are parents or grandparents, regardless of the age of our children, it reminds us that we have the same obligation. And it reminds the entire church of our duty to all the children within our community. And finally, it makes a statement to the world that children really are that important. That it really is worth giving a whole service. And really not just one service. But this is an integral part of our worship, that we want to train our children in the ways of the Lord. And so at this time, I want to ask Tosh and Christy, RT and Lily, if you bring Will up at this time, you can just stand right over here.